From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And we begin with a story of medical technology. Pain associated with burn injuries is considered some of the most severe and challenging to treat, and hundreds of soldiers are returning from Afghanistan and Iraq with extensive burns. An Army hospital in Texas is experimenting with a virtual reality program to help alleviate some of that pain. The program, known as Snow World, was developed by researchers at the University of Washington. Patricia Murphy of member station KUOW reports.
About a year ago, Sergeant Oscar Liberato was with his unit in Iraq when an IED detonated near the Humvee he was riding in. The 23-year-old suffered severe burns on his left arm and hand. He was the only survivor from his group of five.
It was really painful. Sometimes I didn't think I was going to make it, but I don't know.
Liberato is one of a dozen military burn patients being treated at Brooke Army Medical Center in Texas who participated in the study using Snow World. It works essentially through distraction. By wearing high-tech goggles with a wide field of vision, Snow World helps patients block the unpleasant view of their wounds, their charred skin, allowing them to navigate an icy canyon instead. Push a button and throw a snowball at a giant penguin, pelt a mammoth, and it will trumpet angrily. All to the soothing sounds of Paul Simon.
A man walks down the street, he says, why am I soft in the middle now?
I know, Paul Simon. Turns out he's a friend of one of the developers. Sergeant Liberato says Snow World made a big difference for him.
I think the environment makes you feel like you're at peace.
University of Washington researcher Hunter Hoffman says his work with combat burns that tend to cover up to 80% of the body has been promising.
What was very encouraging is the ones who needed it the most were the ones who benefited the most. So the patients that are in the most pain are the ones that showed the most pain reduction from Snow World.
In a handful of civilian hospitals where this technology is already in use, it's a virtual reality helmet that the patient wears to experience the snowy distraction. But combat burn victims are often too injured to wear the helmet. Hoffman's team redesigned the VR unit as a pair of goggles and a joystick. Dr. Christopher Mani is the chief of anesthesia at Brooke Army Medical Center. He says the treatment has reduced stress for nurses as their patients are more comfortable. And then there's the appreciation from soldiers' family members who see a big difference in the emotional well-being of their loved ones.
You know, you can be stopped in the hallways, and a hug is a very simple thing, but it means so much. Those are the true rewards, and it really is making a difference, and it really is helping our patients and their families.
The Army is also researching the use of virtual reality for treatment of PTSD. For NPR News, I'm Patricia Murphy in Seattle.
The United States has allocated $13 billion for the construction of high-speed rail lines over the next 5 years, but China plans to spend $300 billion in the next decade to build the world's most extensive and advanced high-speed rail network. The Chinese government sees it as a strategic investment that will help jumpstart its economy. NPR's Anthony Kuhn recently took a ride on what is now the world's fastest train, and he filed this report.
Workers are putting the finishing touches on a French-designed glass and steel train station on the fringes of Wuhan, a major metropolis on the middle reaches of the Yangtze River. The mostly middle-class passengers line up to board the train. It takes just 3 hours to cover the more than 600 miles to Guangzhou, China's third-largest city in the heart of the industrialized Pearl River Delta. That's 10 hours less than the conventional train takes. In the first class section, where tickets cost upwards of $100, real estate company manager Yang Tao and his wife have swiveled the seats in front of them around and put their feet up. He says he's willing to pay extra for a comfortable ride.
My wife is afraid of flying. Taking this train is more convenient than going to the airport with all the security checks. The flights are often delayed, and the airline's attitude is arrogant.
The train speed is up to 350 kilometers per hour, and the train frequency is up to one every 3 minutes.
onboard video screens show off the train's advanced features. In the dining car, passengers eat roast duck gizzards and spicy noodles and watch the terraced fields and factory towns of South China slip past their windows at speeds averaging almost 220 miles an hour. By 2012, China plans to have almost three dozen high-speed rail lines crisscrossing the country. Legions of workers are now building the Beijing to Shanghai line, which at $32 billion will be China's most expensive construction project ever. Graduate student Grace Huang says the new link between Wuhan and Guangzhou is completely different from the lumbering, claustrophobic boxcars Chinese train travelers are accustomed to.
This train is a big improvement. It's comfortable and spacious, not crowded like regular trains. Of course, there's nothing we can do about that. China just has too many people.
Critics argue that the bullet trains are overkill, and what China really needs is affordable transportation for the masses. Xie Weida, a railway expert at Shanghai's Tongji University, disagrees.
High-speed rail can ease our transportation bottlenecks. Migrant workers may not require high-speed trains, but if some passengers take the high-speed trains, that should relieve pressure on the ordinary ones.
China's leaders say their country will not follow the West's path of development, sacrificing the environment in order to industrialize. China's investment in high-speed rail is a part of this strategy, says Xie Weida.
To solve the problem of public transportation in such a vast country, rail transport is the only way to go. If we rely on airplanes and automobiles like the U.S., neither China nor the world will be able to handle such energy consumption.
Passengers exit the train in Guangzhou and board buses and taxis for the city center. For some Chinese, the high-speed trains have already begun to shorten the distances between cities in their minds. Some observers predict that the trains will begin to stitch together more closely China's patchwork of regional markets, dialects, and cultures. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and today we conclude our look back at the decade that's coming to a close and the dramatic changes we've heard in the music industry with a story about compression, the kind of audio or dynamic compression that's used in a lot of popular music. There's a YouTube video that uses Paul McCartney's 1989 song Figure of Eight as an example. Let's listen. Notice how the drums stand out on the CD as it was released. Now let's listen to how this song might have sounded if it were recorded more recently, using compressors that squash the music to make it uniformly loud so it jumps out of your radio or your iPod.
It really no longer sounds like a snare drum with a very sharp attack. It sounds more like somebody patting on a piece of leather or something like that.
That's Bob Ludwig, a longtime record mastering engineer who directed us to the YouTube video called The Loudness War. Like so many conflicts, Bob Ludwig says it has escalated in recent years.
The thing that kind of brought everything to a head was this latest Metallica release, the Death Magnetic record. It was put out on Guitar Hero. It came out to the fans simultaneously, both as the Guitar Hero and the final CD. And the Guitar Hero doesn't have all the digital domain compression that the CD had. So the fans were able to hear what it could have been before this compression. Apparently 10,000 or more fans signed a petition online to get them to remix the record. That record is so loud, there's an outfit in Europe called ITU that now has standardization measurements for long-term loudness. And that Metallica record is one of the loudest records ever produced. You know, people talk about downloads hurting record sales. I and some other people would submit that another thing that's hurting record sales these days is the fact that they are so compressed that the ear just gets tired of it.
I'm thinking back to a long time ago when I remember working at a top 40 radio station, and somebody put on a 45 and showed me, look at the VU meter right now, and and here's a piece of music. Maybe it was some Phil Spector production. Barely moving during it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, certainly the loudness wars have gone back to the days of 45s. When I first got into the business and was doing a lot of vinyl disc cutting, one producer after another just wanted to have his 45 sound louder than the next guy's, so that when the program director at the top 40 radio station was going through his stack of 45s to decide which two or three he was going to add that week, that the record would kind of jump out to the program director, orally at least.
Now, Bob, we're operating at a paradoxical disadvantage here, because by the time music comes from us here at NPR to our station, it's compressed.
Absolutely. The good news is that the compression that's on those radio station limiters is not quite as bad as you'd find on your local top 40 radio station. It's not like the FCC allows them to broadcast with a bigger signal than the NPR stations. It's just that they're more highly compressed and the ear thinks that it's louder.
Now, I want you to tell me about this recording by Guns N' Roses.
Oh, this was great. Axl Rose had had this record called Chinese Democracy, and he'd had it mastered at a few other places, and everybody was doing the normal make it louder thing, and Axl really wanted it to have the final CD represent what he had mixed, which in this case is many layers of guitars. There's a lot going on in this record, many, many tracks. Lo and behold, when it gets loud, it actually does get louder. And when it gets soft, it gets softer.
So your bottom line verdict from your standpoint on the decade in recorded music?
It's been really rough, folks, but it can get better, and I think it will get better. So I'm glad it's going to be over.
Bob Ludwig, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bob Ludwig is a mastering engineer who's been working in music recording for more than 40 years. Today he runs Gateway Mastering Studios in Portland, Maine. Ludwig was talking about dynamic compression, taking the sound of music and making the quiet parts louder and the loud parts a little quieter so that you're not fiddling with the volume knob while you're driving. Well, there is another kind of compression going on today, one that allows us to carry hundreds of songs in our iPods. And there is a cost to this kind of compression as well. It seems that some sounds are obliterated in the process. Joining us to talk about what we hear and how we hear it is Dr. Andrew Oxenham. He's an associate professor in the psychology department at the University of Minnesota, and his specialty is auditory perception, how our brains and ears interact. He also started out as a recording engineer, by the way. Professor Oxenham, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And I'd like you first to just explain digital compression, the process that allows a song to go from being a very big digital sound file in its natural state to a very small file in your iPod.
That's right. That's really the challenge, is to maintain the quality of a CD, but to stuff it into a much smaller space. Let's think about how digital recording works. You start off with a very smooth sound wave, and we're trying to store that in digital form. So we're really trying to reproduce a smooth curve in terms of these square blocks, which are the digital numbers. And the difference between the smooth curve and the sharp edges that you end up with in the digital recording, you can think of as noise, because that is perceived as noise. It's perceived as an error, something that wasn't there in the original recording. The trick is to take the noise, which is the loss of fidelity, and just make it so that you can't hear it anymore.
So let's say I'm listening to Brahms on my MP3, and it's a loud part of the symphony. Are they cheating a little bit here? Are they actually pulling away lots of bits of that sound, knowing that my ears are going to hear loud orchestra, and I'll process it as loud orchestra no matter what's in there?
That's right. You can think of it that way. The loud sound is giving the coding system a lot of leeway to code things not quite as accurately as it would have to, because the ear is being stimulated so much by the loud sound, it won't pick up very small variations produced by the coding errors.
It sounds like the audio equivalent of a mortgage-backed security. Lots of, you know, they've done a lot of tricky stuff in there in the middle, but the end result looks pretty good. Sounds pretty good.
That's right. It's the sausage factory. You just don't want to know what goes into it.
Well, in the end, are we missing something when we listen to music that is digitized in this fashion, when it's compressed? Or, since we can't hear the difference, is it just as good?
There are really different levels of MP3 coding. You can go from much less data, which people can hear the difference, to higher levels of coding, which take up more space on your MP3 player, but sound better and are basically indistinguishable from the CD. And I would argue that under proper listening conditions, if it's really indistinguishable from the CD, as far as your ear is concerned, then you really haven't lost anything perceptually.
Well, Andrew Oxenham, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Oxenham is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota, where he also works with the Auditory Perception and Cognition Lab. For more examples of compression, you can visit our website, nprmusic.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Moving on now to a big moment in the world of smartphones. The Google phone is coming, as we mentioned in All Tech Considered a couple of weeks ago. That phone, called the Nexus One, is the buzz in advance of the tech industry's biggest extravaganza, the Consumer Electronics Show. It is this week in, where else, Las Vegas. And NPR's Laura Seidel has managed to get a hold of one of the Google phones. Laura, tell us about it. What do you think?
Well, I have to say I really like it, Melissa. It has a nice weight. The screen is about the same size as an iPhone screen. It has a wonderful camera. I actually have to tell you that I did a side-by-side comparison of a photo on the iPhone and a photo on the Google phone. Google phone was better, has flash. The screen moves really quickly. I actually found just navigating through it, the user interface was very fast. It also has longer battery life. The iPhone that I was using had about 8 hours if you were lucky, and it would run out on you. This really lasted, and that means a lot. The other thing is it appears you're going to be able to choose a carrier. So you could choose either T-Mobile or AT&T, but you'll have to pay for the phone separately, which means it might be expensive.
Yeah, and when we say expensive, we're talking maybe $500 if you were to buy it without a phone package.
That is correct. So it could be as much as $500 to actually just buy this phone, which is something Google wanted to do because Google wants to make it possible for people to buy a device without having to sign up with a carrier. Google clearly is trying to start a trend that would separate devices from carriers. For example, people are upset that you have to sign up with AT&T to get an iPhone. Well, what if in the future you could get an iPhone and then choose your carrier? I think Google would like to push us in that direction, and that's one of the reasons they're doing this at all.
And Google here directly taking on Apple. What is the timing of the release of the Nexus One, Laura?
Well, I think what Google's doing is they're trying to eclipse the Consumer Electronics Show, which starts on Thursday. So they have a press conference scheduled tomorrow in Mountain View, which is where everybody believes they're going to announce this phone. So it's a way to say, hey, pay attention to us instead of getting lost in the big floor of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which starts on Thursday.
And what about that show? What's supposed to be big there this year?
Well, you know, you'll see some 3D TV, mobile TV, internet-connected TV, lots of e-books. That's something you're going to see a lot of this year. We've already got the Barnes & Noble Nook. We've got the Kindle. We're going to see more. There's a good chance that by the end of the month, those e-books are going to get eclipsed by Apple. You may have heard rumors about something called an iSlate, which is a tablet computer that everybody is expecting Apple to announce by the end of January. And this is essentially a tablet computer is something where you have a screen and you use a sort of, you know, touch point pen and you can navigate around and it will have 3D images. And everybody's talking about this new iSlate as the second coming. But it would allow you to read things on it. It would allow you to watch movies on it, all kinds of things. And it could eclipse many of those e-books that we're about to see at CES.
Everything's eclipsing everything else very quickly.
Everybody wants to somehow say, hey, my gadget's just the best. And clearly, Google and Apple are the two companies that are putting brackets around this show. Google first by making this announcement on their phone, and then Apple at the end of the month by bringing out their tablet computer, which is supposed to be called the iSlate. That's the rumor.
NPR's Laura Seidel, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And as always, you can check out the All Tech Considered blog up there now. You can find out how NPR Facebook and Twitter fans summarized 2009. We asked you to give us one word to describe last year. We got a variety of answers, of course, but a popular word was ugh. See if your word for 2009 made the list at npr.org/alltech. This is NPR News.
In this country, President Obama is promoting green jobs. They're supposed to help both the environment and the economy, but it turns out that new green jobs may simply replace older jobs. NPR's Chris Arnold has the latest report in our series, New Jobs for a New Decade.
Many old factories around the country now sit dark and empty. But at a once defunct Polaroid film factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts, the lights are on again. And a new industry is rising up inside the ruins of an old one.
Well, we make what's called plastic solar cells. We call it powered plastic.
Rick Hess is the CEO of Canarca. It's a company that makes solar panels, but not like any you've probably seen before. These are thin, flexible plastic sheets. They're lightweight, and some are transparent, so they can be built into windows to let homes or office buildings generate their own solar power. Or the material can be sewn onto a bag or briefcase. And even something that small will generate electricity.
It's enough to charge cell phones or iPods or things like that.
Oh, really? So you could charge your cell phone.
Oh, you can clearly charge your cell phone. I have a bag that I use today that I use to charge my cell phone.
The equipment at this factory used to make big sheets of Polaroid film. Canarca converted it so that these same machines are now churning out these film-like solar panels. And the company's hired back about 20 of the former Polaroid workers to run the factory. So it's given new green jobs to workers who had been laid off. Mike Page is an electrician and machine operator.
You know, I invested my whole career at Polaroid, and then I thought it was over. And now I feel renewed, and I feel like I have a whole new future.
Green jobs are a very big deal in Washington. President Obama has said that he wants to create 5 million new green jobs over 10 years.
The nation that leads in clean energy will be the nation that leads the world. I want America to be that nation.
And it's definitely an attractive idea. So if you want the country to go green, when at the same time it needs a lot more jobs, green jobs seem like the perfect solution. But
even if we hit numbers like 5 million jobs that people talk about, and that's quite plausible, that can only be a very limited piece of the puzzle in a country with several hundred million people.
Michael Levy is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says proponents often only talk about the jobs that will be created, not the jobs that will be lost. And the economy is a big interconnected system. So here's an example. The country only needs so much electricity, but if more of that comes from wind power or solar power, less is going to come from coal. So some coal miners would lose their jobs. Levy says anytime the government pushes the economy in a given direction, you'll gain jobs in some areas and lose them in others.
Let's say I add 5 million jobs and I lose 4 million jobs elsewhere, and it's over 10 years. Within the grander scheme of things, it's other elements of economic policy that are going to change people's lives.
There's also the question of what gets counted as a, quote, green job. The numbers get very mushy here. What about electricians who already have a job but who start installing more efficient furnaces? Should those be counted as new green jobs? Levy thinks that many green jobs will really just be existing jobs that are shifted into this category. Still, other experts see green jobs as a lot more important.
This is at the center of the future of American competitiveness.
Bracken Hendricks is a senior fellow at the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress. He says, take the global auto industry. If companies here in the U.S. can come up with the best electric car technologies,
we're talking about who is going to own the growth of the auto industry globally. In China, they're about to go from 65 million cars on the road to 300 million cars on the road.
Basically, people's views on green jobs depend on their vision of the future. Congressman Ed Markey authored clean energy and green jobs legislation that was recently passed by the House.
We have to think of this as the next great job-creating sector in the same way that we put the correct telecommunications policies on the books in the 1990s that led to an explosion of made-in-America brands, Google, eBay, Amazon.
In the shorter term, the Obama administration is interested in giving Americans incentives to insulate their homes. The idea is to put thousands of contractors to work with insulation and caulk guns. So it's being called cash for caulkers. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
Our series New Jobs for a New Decade continues tomorrow with a look at healthcare workers. And a lot of those products will be on view this week at the annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It's where a lot of new products and gadgets are revealed, and it's expected to draw more than 100,000 visitors, among them NPR's Laura Seidel.
3D TV without those funny glasses, netbooks, and e-books will be among the hottest items at this year's show. Although attendance has not reached pre-recession numbers, the Consumer Electronics Association reports attendance is steady with last year, and the good news is that electronic sales are up almost 6%. Some of the biggest electronics news is expected before and after the show. Google is expected to announce its much-anticipated Nexus One phone today, and Apple is likely to announce it will release a tablet computer later this month. Laura Seidel, NPR News.